Resonance 104.4 FM.
Let a bothered pig see, show you what to do, and this is what he'll tell you. If you got a problem, to know who you are, here now, this is what you do. Remember, you are me, I am you, all of us together.
Receive with simplicity all that happens to you, and welcome to the Naked Short Club on Resonance FM. I am Dr. Stu, your host, Master Engineer Mr. Chris Dixon at the controls. We're coming to you live from one of the City of London's oldest pubs, tucked away just behind the bank in Bonus Pool Alley. What's it called again, Chris? It's the Fox and Forex Fixer. Such a sense of history here. Originally one of those 17th century coffee houses where merchants would meet, share views, pass tips, do deals, set prices and fix rates on a handshake. Tradition's a splendid thing. The multi-billion fines on some of the world's most esteemed banks. Citi, BOA, HSBC, RBS, UBS, JP Morgan, with Barclays under investigation for rigging foreign exchange markets, show how little has changed over the centuries. And some say this exceeds the scandal around LIBOR and Euribor fixing. So too, as in exceedingly expansive, are the expertise and wealth of our guests here from tax havens even more generous than the year. Each has before them their second pint of the delicious products of our corporate sponsors, made of Ponzi beer, the private jet and second yacht owner's choice. Speaking of which, guests, raise your glasses and your voice and tell us, how are you dressed?
We're naked, Dr. Stu.
Sounding drugged and beautiful, like most rich people do. Now, let's have some music while we work out what to talk about.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Naked Short Club on Resonance FM. That was Black Sabbath, and I am Dr. Stu, your host, joined here at the Fox and Forex Fixer by Dr. Peter West, Head of Research, PAM Global, Alex Akeson, Editor, Hedgeco Networks, coming in from Iceland by Tantric Videolink, and here in the flesh, Richard Edwards, CEO, Head Capital, Ian Morley, Chairman, Wentworth Hall. For poetry, we have Anna Delaney. And another round of Madoff Ponzi beer on the way. Thanks, Bernie. Now, let's get cracking. So, Richard Edwards, what's going on?
Stu, I thought we'd talk about oil prices. They've been much in the news lately. But what has not been much mentioned is the fact that, despite the fact we've got an OPEC meeting going on, I believe, right now, Saudi Arabia is mysteriously absent. For many years, Saudi Arabia has pumped more oil when the price gets high, stopped pumping when the price gets low, and has thereby kept prices in a tight trading range. This, of course, is a feedback loop, even though it's a contrived feedback loop. And one thing we know about feedback loops is that when they break, that is when the feedback ceases feeding back, then carnage results. And so the drop that we've seen in oil prices down to, what, around 75, something like that, in the last few days, might presage something much worse. And this despite the fact that Saudi Arabia has enormous, literally enormous foreign exchange reserves, which could enable them to stop pumping tomorrow completely. And so it's a conundrum. Why are they doing it? What's going on? Similar situation obtains in Russia, where they also have enormous remaining foreign exchange reserves, although they're spending them quite quickly. And they need to pump oil to replenish those, or do they? So that's what I've been thinking about.
Cool. And from memory, Saudi has foreign exchange reserves of about $750 billion. And Peter's validating that little bit of punk memory. And
$700 billion as of September.
The Russians, according to the last figures that were fed to me by the NSA, no, not really, by The Economist, I think, had something with a two in front of it by way of hundreds of billions. But that may be, you think it's higher. Richard, what do you think it is?
$400 billion, I think.
In that case,
shrinking.
Dr. Stu's memory eludes him. That may just have been the amount of money, of capital, that has fled Russia this year. Ding, that's it. Gosh, you wouldn't have thought there was anything left to take out of there and deposit in Western banks. Anyway, moving on. Peter West, what's happening?
Well, in Latin America, which I follow particularly closely, one oil-producing country which is running out of money is Venezuela. So maybe we could talk about that in a bit more detail. But the country really which people are focusing on this week is Brazil, because Dilma Rousseff, having won the elections and been voted in for a second term of office, much to the chagrin of the markets, is due to name her new economic team. And the markets are looking for her to appoint people who will be more friendly to investors and change the course of economic policy, which unfortunately has seen Brazil grind to a halt with stubbornly high inflation. There's a guy called Jim O'Neill who invented the term BRICS many years ago, Brazil being the first of those, Russia, India and China being the others. Well, Brazil, unfortunately, is a brick which has fallen out of the wall.
Not a bad pun for a member of the Worldwide Confederacy of Hedgy Scum. Now, that was pretty good, Peter. And wouldn't... Very funny, Richard. I would, Dr. Stu, wouldn't mind later on hearing a bit about what's going on elsewhere in Latin America. One wonders whether some of the low productivity chickens may be in the process of coming home to roost there. Anyway, on to Ian. Ian, what's on your mind?
Well, I spend most of my holidays in Saudi Arabia and Russia and South America. I've never been to, but it doesn't stop me writing reports on TripAdvisor about all the hotels I have or haven't stayed on. So I could talk about those, but I won't. I was told that censorship was applying tonight, so I can't talk about football, sex, politics or religion. And Anna's apparently got the control over poetry. So I will talk about hedge funds. Sorry about that, the audience. I suppose the issues that are concerning me are the EU, whether we're going to be in and out or out, and all the new regulation that's coming in and whether, in fact, it's just a tax on investors or won't prevent any fraud or market failure. The issue that hedge funds, particularly global macro hedge funds, are facing with central bankers actually making all the decisions in the markets. The interesting area of hedge funds and private equity funds that are often found in the same space but have completely different views on risk management. The role of consultants in the industry and whether some of them have got conflicts of interest or not. And short selling, which was all over the Financial Times, which is a pink newspaper which I wrap my chips in every day, is also one of the main issues that concerns me.
Yeah, and the Financial Times really does seem to have a bee in its bonnet about hedge funds, that black flag anarchist rag that it is. And in fact, listeners, in a couple of weeks' time, our friend Miles Johnson, who's the hedge fund correspondent at the FT, will be coming on to the Naked Short Club to regale us with his view of such things.
Not shown you by The Economist, you know.
Dr. Stu doesn't have to buy any of this stuff. These things are given as freebies. That's what comes with being Dr. Stu. Anyway, moving on, let's hear now from Alex Akerson, who is here with us by astral projection from Iceland. First, though, thanks to Richard for passing around those little white pills that in Britain are marketed as polo mints, in the US as lifesavers, and the hallucinogens they contain really are a form of lifesaver, particularly in a year where hedge funds' performance in aggregate terms has been pretty damn pathetic. Anyway, listeners will be delighted that lines are now open to the Emergency Hedge Fund Helpline on 1-800-DISTRESSED, and Bernie, Raj, Stevie, and the rest of the team are just waiting for your calls. I am Dr. Stu, and I'm here for the issues that dog you. Now, Alex Akerson, what's on your mind?
Hello, Dr. Stu. My topic is green. Yes, I'd like to talk about the promotion of green energy on Wall Street and the kind of hedge funds that plan to trade on the legalization of medical and recreational marijuana in the U.S.
Go ahead.
There are now 23 legal states. Much is to be said about where those profits will be going. Also, activist hedge funds and the Keystone Pipeline, how they lost by a razor-thin vote in the Senate last week. That's my 2 cents I'll be talking about. Thank you.
To me, that's more like two big gold dollars. Very interesting topics indeed. I think we're all going to have to gather our thoughts and also get another round of that delicious Madoff Ponzi beer. So in the meantime, let's make poetry with Anna Delaney.
I was cycling down the Edgware Road by Simon Mole. I was cycling down the Edgware Road. It was perfect. Grey pavement, dirty smudges, one red telephone box, Alpha Rabi Pharmacy, Abu Ali Restaurant, Argos, Islamic Bank of Britain, Summerfield. The day is falling off me. Al Baraka Supermarket, Al Safiya Salon, and the ache within my calves makes my pale indoors life natural. Tesco Metro, Beirut Express, Himalaya Carpets Limited, Halal Fish and Chips. I sip shallow breaths of city dust, watch men in wicker chairs just there next to me, drink coffee and juice, talk quickly, smoke cigarettes and peat shisha, sweet and rich. This is the first time you heard that record that sings to you to summers yet to come. So, I was cycling down the Edgware Road, and then I saw him. He was perfect. Maybe 50 feet away, smart dark suit, black briefcase, weary of the rough, but late. His expectant eyes scanned the swollen current of this river from its bank, until there is one now. Black cab, no passengers. He lifts his arm to signal. Should be home already, this one's mine. Right, so I was cycling down the Edgware Road, and I saw him. I'd been waiting for a moment like this for some time. It was perfect. Because at first, I thought by the time I'd reach him, he might be gone. Or, worse, that the voice of sensible inside my head would make me bottle out and drag me home and watch me chalk this up on my extended back brain blackboard of regrets. But then, the bus in front moves. It's now. Feet push pedals, spokes were wind perfect. Because as I get close, He's still waiting, arm out, palm spread wide like he's waving. I take my left hand off the handlebars, raise it high behind my head, and slap it hard against his outstretched hand. 1, 2, 3, 4. And yes, as high fives go, it was perfect. Crisp, clean, with a genuine connection, the type to leave your hand tingling with the memory of the sound. As for him, his reaction and the street around him, I don't know. I didn't look back.
Cool. Now, we do have lots more to talk about, so while we have a little confer and decide what we are going to talk about, Mr. Chris Dixon, let's have some more music. Welcome back to the Naked Short Club. That was Solus 3, and I am Dr. Stu, your host, engineer Mr. Chris Dixon at the controls. Now, listeners, you're tuned to Not For Profit, the Resonance FM, London's leading voice of radio art, the arts, the particular, and the unexpected. Nearly 3 million listeners worldwide, and if you want to fight both UKIP and global hunger, go to the Resonance website and make a donation to the station. Now, very quick recap of what people were talking about. We were hearing from Peter about Latin America and Brazil and Venezuela, from Richard about oil and Saudi Arabia and feedback loops and Russia, and from Ian about regulation and the EU and the central banks driving markets and institutional consultants and possible conflicts of interest embedded in how they go about things, and from Alex about hedge funds and green energy, and about marijuana funds, which will be quite interesting to hear about. Dr. Stew did mention a few months ago that he was at an agricultural conference in New York and ran into what purported to be the first of the wave of marijuana investment funds taking advantage of the progressive legalization of the substance over in the U.S. And I think Alex mentioned that 23 states now have it as legal or not. Anyway, let's just get cracking. Let's start with Richard and take it from there. Richard.
Stu, on the subject of feedback, if you forgive a short lecture, there are two forms of feedback, positive and negative. Positive feedback gets all the attention because it leads to self-reinforcing trends. Think of the price of real estate in London, where there is an underlying shortage. Prices start to go up. It doesn't provoke more building. It doesn't inhibit demand. Instead, higher prices provoke more demand as more people come in. Speculators and investors both like a rising price, and so it provokes generally more buying. Negative feedback is a lot more subtle. And that is closer to what economists refer to as an equilibrium. And so prices rise, it does stimulate supply, prices then fall, possibly with a little bit of a lag, which then stimulates demand, and you end up with a trading range. It's not necessarily a very well-defined trading range. You see examples of this in the cocoa market, where there's a four-year cycle, which sometimes gets swamped by other factors, but it recurs. You see it in the American business cycle, where the Federal Reserve interacts with the natural tendency of the economy to grow, and so on. But in the case of the oil market, Saudi Arabia is the contriver, with the occasional assistance of the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait, of an artificial feedback loop. So, as I pointed out earlier on, it's well known that when the price is low, the Saudis stop pumping, and when the price goes high, they increase supply. It's in their interest, of course, for the prices not to shoot too high, lest the world discover alternatives and put them out of business. Now, however, and of course, that then becomes self-fulfilling because others notice that the price is low and so they start buying it. Others notice that when the price is high and they start selling it. And so other participants come in, join the cycle and keep the range stable. It's clearly broken recently. And some people attribute this to shale oil and gas from America, some to the fact that Saudi Arabia has become so poor that it can't afford anymore to stop pumping, which is clearly not true because their foreign exchange reserves are still very healthy. But clearly something has happened. There is a slight shortfall in demand, perhaps there's a slight excess of supply, and that's just been too big to manage. And so the whole thing has crashed, and oil prices have fallen by 30% from a recent high. That was the high point of the range, of course. More importantly, they've fallen maybe 10% below the former low point of the range. And having done that, now they'll probably continue to fall. There is, of course, a lot of bearish sentiment about crude oil around right now. You read the newspapers and you would believe that prices are going to fall down to $30 a barrel, $40 a barrel immediately. It's quite likely that from here we'll get some sort of bounce. But then when there is a bounce, unless Saudi Arabia changes its mind and resumes its prior policy, then it's likely that the decline will resume. And you have to ask, why? Why is it that the Saudis are doing this? What is it that they're trying to achieve? Because very rarely do they act on purely commercial grounds. And Saudi Arabia is a famously political operator at the very highest levels. And so the classic question is, who benefits? And so if Saudi Arabia has acquiesced in lower oil prices, because it could have defended the oil price, then why? What are they trying to achieve? And I suspect that it's the political situation in the Middle East at large, and they would like to harm their perennial foe, Iran.
Let me give you some feedback on the feedback. And the first feedback is on the poem, because I have to share this with everyone that's listening, that in fact it's not a poem at all. It's Anna's personal diary, and I was the guy getting into the taxi, and that's why we're here tonight. On Saudi Arabia, I agree with Richard, but then I always agree with Richard, so we have to disagree to make it interesting. I think the Saudi aim is always to have market share, irrespective of price, because they know that if they can grab market share, the cost of the marginal producers is always such that once they're knocked out, it takes them quite a long time to get back in. And because they have those reserves and because they have their power, it's the market share they're trying to gain. Can I go on and natter now about consultants? No? Yes? You're nodding your head. I can. Right. Okay. Consultants. Those of you who've got geriatric problems or gynecological problems, you should listen very carefully now, because I'm not going to talk about anything that's relevant to you. The consultants I'm talking about are those people who, like me, used to sell hedge funds, and now we provide consultancy to institutions and we stop them from buying them. Or we hope they buy the right ones. And what I mean by that is that having sold this stuff, I now sit there on the opposite side of the table when people come and sell it, and I act as the filter. And there are a few of us upstanding ethical figures in this industry, alone, providing resistance to those who would try and sell stuff from a conflicted point of view. So the role of the consultant is to stand in front of the pension fund. The pension fund has fiduciary responsibility. It's everyone out there with their money, which they're going to retire on, which they can then spend on their cats, their dogs, and their lovers, and whatever else they may want to do with it. So we have to make sure they do it well. And some consultants come along and they say, oh, well, not only can we consult, that is an independent role, but we can also provide the solution. Now, when you're providing the solution, which involves very often the fund that you manage, those consultants end up then with a direct conflict of interest. And I think, I fear, I know that this is a growing problem in the industry that we're going to have to face down and talk about it publicly on radio stations like this, so we can challenge those who do not actually have true independence, but have something hidden.
Actually, I'd just like to add a word on oil prices, because I don't go for the conspiracy type theories which were just enunciated. I do think, and I agree with Ian on this, that Saudi Arabia's acting out of its own self-interest. And I think it was Sheikh Yamani who once said that the world, that the Stone Age ended long before the world ran out of rocks. And this is, you know, what's driving Saudi Arabia. They don't want the oil age to end while they've still got lots of oil in the ground. Anyhow, what I'd really wanted to talk about in more detail is Latin America, following on Stu's question. And it is very difficult to generalize. But one generalization is that Latin America did ride the commodities supercycle. And now that that supercycle has ended, weaknesses are being exposed, and particularly in terms of economic policy. And I think you can sort of group the region into three separate categories. Firstly, you've got, as it were, the good guys, which are grouped in a new alliance called the Pacific Alliance. And as that name suggests, they're the countries which are on the Pacific coast, starting with Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and Chile. These are all countries which have got, if you like, appropriate economic policies. And in the case of Mexico, they've reinitiated the reform process, with the opening up of the energy sector being the main reform there, which should boost productivity growth over the medium term. Then you've got the other end of the spectrum, the countries with poor economic policies. Those are Argentina and, in particular, Venezuela, which are not doing too well at all. I think they've got, out of the major economies, they're the top two in terms of inflation. 65% in the case of Venezuela, 40% or thereabouts in the case of Argentina. And then Brazil is sort of somewhere in the middle, a lot closer to the good guys than the bad guys, but it's been drifting off in the wrong direction under the first Dilma administration. And that's why the markets were so disappointed when she got re-elected, because they favoured Aécio Neves, because they thought, probably rightly, that he would try and take Brazil back towards the good guy camp. Now the question is, what's Dilma going to do? Is she going to try and rectify policies? And the first important signal of that will be in the naming of the economic team, which we are expecting this week.
So you're saying that the markets didn't want a balmy socialist and that they got one? I should say that if I were you.
Richard, I'd expect better of you than that. Come on.
I have no better to offer than that. You know that still.
Go on.
On the subject of conspiracy, from the Latin conspire, to breathe together, you can't have a conspiracy of one. So Saudi Arabia's pumping to keep the oil price down. It's certainly not a conspiracy. I have another candidate. It may be that they're not aiming at Iran. It may be that they're aiming at shale oil.
because the not shale gas, because that's a different market, but shale oil, because the marginal cost of production, as far as anybody can determine it across such a wide area, of shale oil seems to be of the order of $70 to $75 a barrel, which will probably shrink once economies of scale come in. But at present prices, all of the shale oil investment which has been made in the continental US is under threat. And it may be, just to pursue this conspiracy of one idea, that the idea is to shut that down so as to restore the proper place of Middle Eastern oil in the world's economy. That's actually a more plausible idea, I think.
I agree entirely with that. And
so now we're a conspiracy of three.
Excellent. But that's sort of putting, you know, giving an idea of what the floor is on oil prices. And it's around 65-ish in terms of when the prices will get low enough to really start affecting U.S. Shale oil production.
That's very true. However, there is a problem with commodity markets, because with leveraged trading, you often find that prices will fall well below the cost of production. Once upon a time, I started off as a young man in the sugar trade, and sugar is packed in polyjute bags. And the price at this particular time when I joined the market was falling and falling and falling and falling, and it fell and it fell. And everybody said, well, the cost of production is this, and the price is now below it. And we realized that the floor underneath the price was the value of the polyjute bag in which it was packed.
I have two very short, brief comments. One is that I think Shell is actually in a conspiracy with the US government to close down BP. And the other one is, I'd like to correct Dr. Peter. It wasn't Sheikh Ghamani who said that the Stone Age ended long before we ran out of stones. It was, of course, Fred Flintstone.
Ha, 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 ha. I'm wondering whether the Saudis aren't bringing down the oil price in order to stop the Russians with that $200-something billion that they've evidently brought out of Russia through capital flight this year, stop them competing for central London real estate. Now, enough of you.
Or the World Cup.
Yeah. I think you all need to sober up. Alex, over there in Iceland, you're probably on the same stuff as us, and I hope you're enjoying the products of our sponsors, Madoff Premium Ponzi Beer. But I wonder if you have anything you'd like to add to what these plutocrats have been banging on about. And over and beyond that, once you've commented, if you have anything to say on that, want to hear more about hedge funds and green energy, and also, you know, the marijuana thing.
Okay. Well, when it comes to the oil prices, I'm just going to side with Rupert Murdoch and blame Obama. But with the end of the pot prohibition, well, it seems that the U.S. is going to pot, Dr. Stu. Large national banks, well, they seem to be afraid to be doing business with the pot people, you know, federal regulations and all. So Colorado has just legalized a credit union for pot stores called the Fourth Corner Credit Union, which approved over the weekend. So also four states have legalized marijuana for recreational use. The major hedge fund right now that I wanted to talk about was called ArcView Capital. They predicted $18 to $30 billion in profit annually. Other funds are Green, let me see what's called, the Ghost Group and Emerald Ocean Capital. And the size of the legal cannabis industry in 2014 is, what, $2.8 billion. Anyway, that was what I was going to talk about, along with a woman who runs this group. It's called Poseidon Asset Management. So there's massive potential, it's untapped, it's just sitting there below the surface and is ready to come above ground. That's about it, Dr. Stu, unless anyone has anything else to
well,
add.
Well, Richard seems to have sobered up a bit and wants to speak, so let's go over to him.
Hick. Commercial marijuana cultivation, possible. If the stuff is legalized, then of course the teenagers will probably not want to smoke it anymore because it's not forbidden. However, there are some inveterate, habitual, enthusiastic users, and it might just become part of the conventional way of taking the strain off, along with alcohol and Valium. So I think we must assume that there's going to be some sustained demand for it. And that introduces an interesting economic feature, which is that everywhere in the world where drugs are grown, they drive out other forms of agriculture. And so famously in Helmand province in Afghanistan, the farmers grow poppies for opium because that makes more money for them than growing
cabbages.
Richard,
do you mean that in effect that part of Afghanistan experienced something equivalent to like the Dutch disease that the Dutch had when they had their natural gas and oil boom, where it hollowed out the rest of the economy? Is that what you're saying?
I do believe so. But the best example of all is in Yemen, where the narcotic leaf qat, which looks like a privet hedge and tastes very much the same, I'm assured, has driven out all forms of agriculture and means that Yemen has not been self-sufficient in agriculture for a very long time, despite being a third world country. And so you must assume that American agricultural land, which is already under enormous pressure for acreage because of the mandated use of ethanol in gasoline and the market-driven use of high-fructose corn syrup as a sweetener, which puts enormous upward pressure on land prices in the States, will be joined by yet another illegal crop. And so I think we're just going to have to invent some more acreage somehow.
Yes. I quite like Boardwalk Empire, and I'd much prefer that it remains illegal because the characters selling it then are far more interesting than if it ever becomes legalized. The problem, well, from a free market point of view, obviously, if you legalize it, and we know it should be legalized, putting moral arguments aside, the cost of drugs has fallen across the world.
You say that we know that it should be legalized.
I'm talking from an economic point of view, not from an ethical point of view, because the cost of drugs has become cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. So all the effects of stopping it have failed, and we've wasted a huge amount of money. And if you legalize them all, then what you can do is you can tax them, and you can have quality control. And the parallel with bootlegging, which is where the Boardwalk Empire came in, is pretty clear to me. So you can't stop people drinking. You can't stop people. You can't legislate against these things. So it's far better to quality control them and tax them. And that's clearly the way we're going with drugs. And probably if there's a hedge fund investing in it for a short period of time until the market gets saturated, maybe quite a good place to be.
Yeah, of course, we're not. You know, the Naked Short Club doesn't really have the function of advocating, you know, whether policymakers should do X, Y, or Z with things like that. I mean, we do promote free love and also the products of made off premium Ponzi beer, our corporate sponsors, and also, in fact, Resonance FM's latest and tastiest corporate supporters, the Naked Nut Company of Visalia, California, which is only 4,530 miles due west of here. But, you know, the reality is that, guys, we're not here to say it's a good thing, it's a bad thing, it's just can we make money out of it? Peter, I wonder if you want to pick up on this.
Yeah, not on the pot issue, because I don't really have anything to add on that. But coming back to oil prices, I think it's a lot more important to talk about the consequences of lower oil prices rather than arguing about different types of conspiracy theory. And you're assuming that prices are going to be lower for a sustained period of time, and I think that's a pretty appropriate assumption. And what counts here is not what level prices fall to or rise to at any specific point of time. What's important is the average over a sustained period of time. Assuming that oil prices on average next year are going to be substantially lower than during the past few years, that has all sorts of economic and financial consequences. For world economic growth, on balance, it should be positive because oil consumers tend to spend more of their income than oil producers. But there will be losers as well as winners. Obviously, the losers are the oil-producing countries, and particularly those without external buffers. That's why Venezuela is so much in the limelight. But Russia's a loser as well, particularly when you combine this with the Western sanctions. And lower oil prices, you know, I could go on, but one other consequence is a reduction in inflationary pressures. And this brings us to the ECB, because the Eurozone is flirting with deflation. If oil prices stay at these low levels or even go down further, we could have real deflation in the Eurozone. And that's what Mr. Draghi is fighting with the Germans to try to prevent. So I think that's an issue we ought to go into a bit more detail about, given the comments of Draghi last week that he is contemplating buying sovereign bonds.
Well, that's a winner for him, if you like. Whatever happened to the idea that inflation was always and is always to be primarily a monetary phenomenon, and deflation therefore the same? So deflation is not the same as falling prices. Inflation is not the same as rising prices. It's true we seem to be flirting with deflation, but would it not be fair to say that if oil prices fall, yes, it's like a tax cut. One of the surest ways to generate economic activity is a tax cut if you can afford it. Perhaps even if you can't afford it, it might even be worth borrowing for a tax cut sometimes. And that would then stimulate economic activity and with it consumption and therefore lift prices and demand and produce a non-deflationary environment. So, I mean, I do read a lot that falling prices are the same as deflation, but surely Milton Friedman settled that a long time ago.
Well, actually, having gone to the University of Cambridge and been brought up in the Keynesian tradition, I do not believe that inflation is just a monetary problem. And
I was at Cambridge too.
And Friedman certainly didn't win all the arguments. And just look at what's been happening recently. Central banks have been pumping out money like mad and they've produced no inflation. So it's a bit more complicated than that.
Well, by the time Dr. Stu did a few economics courses, well, actually a few degrees in his spare time, frankly, Keynes was discredited, at least for the time being. And I'm afraid the kind of monetarism that so many people in the markets keep spouting really should go back to 1980, where it belonged for its very brief heyday. I'm appalled that anyone should still even mention Friedman without spitting on the ground. God bless him. Anyway, on that note, let's have some music.
Thank you.
welcome back to the Naked Short Club on Resonance FM. That was Gong from the new album I See You, and I am Dr. Stu, your host. Gong play the Garage in London on Friday the 28th. They'll be joined for that gig in David and Orlando Allen's absences by Steve Hillage, Mike Howlett, Andy Bowl, and a host of other members of the extended Gong family, and Dr. Stu will be there. Anyway, check the Planet Gong website, www.planetgong.co.uk, for details of the gig and other planned activities. Anyway, let's get going again and let's try and round things off. Let's start with you, Alex, over there in Iceland. Over to you.
Hi. I was impressed by activist hedge fund manager Tom Steyer. He's now retired, but he may have actually had an impact through a super PAC's anti-Keystone advertising. The Senate vote was 41 to 59 against just last week. Steyer put $50 million of his own money into the super PAC Next Gen Climate Action. And he put out stinging attack ads like Sucker Punch. And so I guess that means that there are some, you know, activist environmentalists among the bigwigs on Wall Street. He also donated $71 million during the midterms, well, I guess, focusing on the environment. And I guess that turned out all right with Obama signing a peace treaty for green, happy stuff with China. And the other hedge fund managers who are activists, they put out a documentary directed by James Cameron called Year of Living Dangerously on Showtime, funded by Chris Owen, Jeremy Grantham, and Steve Mandel, Children's Investment Fund, GMO LLC, and Lone Pine Capital. So, I mean, that's something. Back to you, Dr. Stu.
Yeah, quite interesting, because over in the U.S. there are a lot of donors to the Democrats and supporters of liberal, you know, quite open supporters of liberal causes in the hedge fund space on this side of the Atlantic. Rather fewer of their equivalents. They're not entirely absent, but yeah, it's just somewhat different in London and the rest of Europe. Now, rounding off, over to you, Ian.
Well, just picking up on that pick about activists, environmentalists, I am one. I have a conflict of interest, though. I do sell umbrellas in Borough High Street on Saturday morning. but I have invested in green energy. And as soon as I finish my plate of vegetables, I put them in the garden and watch them grow. And I've noticed that they do extremely well when they have government subsidy. And that seems to be the main attraction. The question is at the margin when they have to stand on their own feet. We're going to need to see some technological advances that will take them off that dependency, the drug dependency, the marijuana forthcoming dependency on government subsidy, to make them be a real alternative in the long term. And the only other issue I have with it, apart from the government subsidy, is that the people who propose it often get messianic and wait till their heating systems break down and turn off and their air conditioning doesn't work and their cars come to a grinding halt. We're going to have some balance of reality at the margin where we're going to bring these things together, not in a messianic way, but in a practical way to make it work.
Interesting that you should bring up the toxic subject of subsidy, because there are lots of different forms of green energy generation, and many of them get pretty much equal newspaper coverage. So solar, thermal, solar voltaic, rotting vegetables, wind power, are all kind of lumped together under green or alternative energy generation. But you can't avoid the physics. All of the energy that we find useful, all of the energy that we can capture and use, starts off as solar energy. Whether it be oil reserves, which were laid down hundreds of millions of years ago, or coal at the same time, or whether it's wind now, which is produced by the operation of weather, which is in turn caused by the rays of the sun. It all originates from the sun. And so to try and capture energy which has been processed through plants, through biofuels, or energy which is produced by wind, which is a secondary effect, these are inherently unlikely to succeed. The only one which I think has any possibility of succeeding is solar, whether it be solar voltaic or solar thermal, because the sun's rays have a certain density of energy as it hits the Earth's surface. And simply, the arithmetic shows that if you carpet enough of the Earth in solar cells and you can capture a sufficient proportion of the energy, then you have a chance of making a serious contribution. Nothing else can work. And there are those who are happy with the idea of subsidy. But ask those investors in Spain who finance the Iberdrola windmills, which carpet every mountaintop in Spain. Once they cut the subsidy, that's it. No more windmills. The last windmill has been built in Spain.
Yeah, actually, on the issue of drugs and dependency, financial markets, in a way, have been very dependent over the recent years, have been hooked on central bank liquidity. And, you know, that raises the issue of what happens when that liquidity is withdrawn. Will they be able to stand on their own 2 feet? In this regard, we've probably got some time further. We can we're going to be hooked on this for a while longer. The Fed is, as we know, preparing to hike rates sometime next year. But the other central banks, the major central banks in the world, are going in the opposite direction. And just to note that China cut rates at the end of last week. It took everybody by surprise. So, you know, the Fed's going to be tightening, but the People's Bank of China, the Bank of Japan and the ECB hopefully will be easing.
What's taken me by surprise, Dr. Stu's astonished that after all that Madoff Ponzi beer you folks have been guzzling, that you've been able to even make halfway coherent points in the last few minutes. Anyway, let's get you a little bit more sober before we call the markets. In the meantime, let's hear again from Anna.
Du le ciel, Carol Gaya. Du le ciel, qu'on passe les hirondelles, quand le temps s'arrête et nos yeux doucement se guettent. Serein de rêver dans le calme des nuits d'été, quand nos esprits se fondent émerveillés, tout au long des sentiers embaumés. Soivent les mélodies quand elles se jouent tendrement, quand tout n'est pas dit et nos mots se perdent dans le vent. Enivrante, la brise, quand elle souffle sur nos fronts et nous prend dans une douce dérive en valsant nos cœurs à l'unisson. Paisible aube lumineuse, quand elle emporte nos rêves et lentement au son d'une berceuse, nos corps vers le ciel s'élèvent.
Speaking of literature, should mention that Ian Morley's had a book published, Morley's Laws of Business and Fund Management, and it's been described as the most important book since the Bible, though Dr. Stu's sure he'll settle instead for, say, the Communist Manifesto or The Joy of Sex. It's published by Paragon and available on Amazon. Excellent stuff. Anyway, we all have flights to catch back to our respective tax havens. So very quickly, starting with you, Alex, where would you invest your money over the next 12 months and why?
Oh, Alibaba. Because Alibaba.
Beautiful name. Ian.
Well, clearly, based on what Alex has said, marijuana, probably rental property. I'd go long the US dollar, and I like disruptive technology.
Okay, Peter.
Equities in emerging market Asia, because they're mainly net oil importers, and they're going to benefit from this low oil price world we're moving into.
Okay, and Richard.
A double put ETF on US Treasury bonds.
Okay, none of that makes any sense, not so much because you don't know what you're talking about normally, but because it's gibberish. Anyway, listeners, don't act on what you hear here. Invest only with regulated professional advice. Dr. Stu, nevertheless, thanks all of you. Great guests, Anna Delaney, Alex Ackerson, Peter West, Richard Edwards, Ian Morley. Thanks, as always, to engineer Chris Dixon and to all the callers to the Emergency Hedge Fund Helpline and to the Switchboard team. Sorry we couldn't run through all the callers this week. Anyway, biggest thanks are actually to our corporate sponsors, Madoff Ponzi Beer, without whom the Naked Short Club yacht would be all we've got, but we have two, thanks to Bernie. And also thanks to Resonance FM's latest and tastiest corporate supporters, the Naked Nut Company, Crunch Yum Delicious. So, next week in Jerusalem, leaving you with the sound of Jimi Hendrix, just remember, doing as you'd be done by, and loving kindness are all that really matter. The rest is just commentary.
Happy New Year, first of all. Well, we have about a million or 2 million more of them. If we can get over the summer. Yeah. We'd like to dedicate this one to such a draggy scene that's going on. All the soldiers that are fighting in Chicago and Milwaukee and New York. Oh, yes, and all the soldiers fighting in Vietnam. We'd like to do a thing called Machine Gun.
You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. That was another edition of the Naked Short Club with Dr. Stu. Coming up at 10:30, we've got The Gravy with Will Ward and Patrick Saville. Before that, though, at 10 o'clock, we've got Daniel Lewis Tyson, because he's available.
Listening to Resonance 104.4 FM.